Thanks so much, Leslie. Thanks everybody for being here. My name is Pat. I am a compulsive overeater and I'm the speaker for this session. I'll qualify briefly. I've been in this fellowship for 34 years. I came in February of 1986. I have 25 years of current abstinence and I'm maintaining a 95 pound weight loss. So you can do the math, and that 25 is smaller than 34. So that tells you that relapse is part of my story. And thankfully it is not the end of my story, because you know the 25 years has been consistently imperfect but consistent. And I am incredibly grateful to my higher power. I used to think that long timers were the special breed of people. And now that I am a long timer, I realize that all that means is that I didn't leave and I didn't die. I think the rest of my qualification, I'm just going to kind of intersperse with talking about our topic, because I can't think of a better topic for the current time than isolation versus self-care. And, you know, isolation was a word that I used to shy away from and I didn't think applied to me, but I know now that, oh my goodness, it absolutely does. Because it's actually one of the hallmarks of our disease. In our 12, OA 12 and 12, the second edition on page 91, it says that we compulsive eaters have lived much of our lives in isolation. Many of us preferred to be alone so that we could eat the way we wanted without interference. Even when we were surrounded by other people, it became progressively more difficult for us to connect with them as our obsession with food, body size, and eating grew. Some of us felt like failures whenever we had to ask for help from anyone other than ourselves. Our desire to live free of compulsive eating has forced us to change these attitudes. Recovery began for most of us when we got out of isolation and into an OA group. Here we discovered we were not alone. As we opened our hearts to other OA members, we found acceptance, a sense of belonging, and unity with other compulsive overeaters that satisfied us in ways that food never could. So there, to me, is in a nutshell what the problem and what the solution is. And one of the things that really struck me as I was thinking about it, because I did a kind of a deep dive into our literature to prepare for this. That's kind of my MO. I always go to the literature, even though I may not quote any of it, is that isolation can take many forms. And that was what always used to trip me up, because I'm a capital E extrovert. And so I always thought that I didn't isolate because I was always around a lot of people. But isolation absolutely can take the form of, you know, where it says another place in our 12 and 12 about that, you know, that we isolated, we never grew up, we isolated, we hid, and we ate. Yeah, I did that. I had my times where I was alone in my room or in my kitchen or my living room with the bag or the box of whatever, fill in the blank. But that wasn't the only way that isolation affected me. Sometimes I isolated by being so busy by packing. We have a disease of more whatever. It isn't only more food. I wanted more fill in the blank. And so I overfilled my life. I binged on activity. And that's a really good way to be isolated, because if I'm moving at the speed of light and never actually pausing, how can I actually be connected with anybody? One of the big ways that I isolated before was in wearing masks. Because if I'm not being real, then I'm not being connected. When I was in my disease, I always wore a mask. I was this person when I was with you, and I was this person when I was with you, and I was this person when I was with you. And what the hell was I going to do if I was with all three of you? It got to the place where I didn't know where the mask started and I stopped, or the mask stopped and I started, rather. So wearing masks, being false, was absolutely a way that I isolated. And another way that I isolated was by being a know-it-all, and by acting like I had no weaknesses. I was not needy. Because that was one of the things that I always heard before, was that I was too loud, I was too emotional, I was too needy. So early in recovery, I adopted the stance of being not needy. I was going to be strong. I was going to be independent. I was going to pull up my own big girl pants. And that can be really, really seductive. But that also cut me off from other people because I wasn't an actual fallible member of the human race. And it was an easy trap for me to fall into. I came into OA in a really tiny town, population 12,000. It was a county seat. And there was one meeting. And there wasn't a lot of recovery in that meeting. There wasn't a lot of abstinence. And I was not at my top weight, even though when I came in, even though I was absolutely at rock bottom despair, because I had everything I thought I wanted and I still hated myself and I wanted to die. And, so it didn't take me long to get down to a normal body size. And so people thought I had it made in my meeting, and particularly since I learned how to talk the talk a lot faster than I learned how to walk the walk. I saw a lot of my affirmation, a lot of my worth in achievement. And so I approached OA when I came in back in 86, I approached it like I approached school, and I got my bachelor's degree in 3 years. So I approached it as I was going to zip through this and I was going to do it perfectly, right? And everything. So I became the shell answer woman in my home meeting. And the problem with that is that we're sick as we're secretive. And so the more I hid the fact that I still had garbage, that I still, I'm still a sick puppy. And I certainly was a sick puppy back all those years ago. I'm still sick. I'm just a little less sick, in today. But is the garbage build up? And so eventually what happened is that I picked up. So I can do any and all, I've done any and all of those forms of isolation. And isolation really disconnects me from my higher power, and if I'm disconnected from my higher power and I'm disconnected from the people around me, then I'm all alone in the universe. And if I'm all alone in the universe, I knew exactly that I was crazy and miserable. That's what had me crawling into OA. So what was I going to do? To me, the antidote to isolation is connection. And one of the things that it talks about in the literature, and it said in that quote that I read from our 12 and 12 is that, when we become a part of, and a lot of times in the literature it talks about that we first become connected at step five when we do our fifth step. But my experience and my belief, it actually starts a little earlier because I become connected for the first time really in step one. When I say step one and I say we, it doesn't say I admitted I was powerless over food. It says we admitted we were powerless over food. I became a part of a we when I said the first step. I become a little bit more connected when I discovered that there was actually a power greater than me and greater than food in the universe. Now, I'm somebody that came in with a belief in God, but I really wasn't letting that relationship work for me. What I did basically is I talked at God, which is how I handled all the other relationships in my life. I talked at them. I didn't have conversations. I had versations where I would verbalize at you at great length. Just ask me, I'll tell you. And so I would go on and on. And that's what I did basically with God. And because I would have told you back in the day that I believed in a loving and caring and blah, 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 all these wonderful spiritual things about God. What my life would have told you that I believed is that I was Charlie Brown and God was Lucy with a football. You know how Lucy and Charlie Brown with a football and Lucy would always yank it away at the last minute and pull the rug out from under Charlie Brown. That's really how I believed my higher power was. I didn't serve a loving God. I served a vengeful and capricious God that needed to be appeased. That's what my life told you until I came into OA. And I had to develop a new relationship with a power greater than myself that had to be a benevolent God that really did have my back. And in step three, then I started developing that real relationship with a power greater than myself. To be connected rather than isolated means that I had to be connected with myself. Before program, I was a really good martyr. I was really a really good people pleaser and a really good martyr. So I didn't do any self-care. What I did is I took care of you and I took care of you and I took care of you. And that's how I got my self-worth. And I wouldn't do things like, you know, I was a stay-at-home mommy. So I didn't feel like I was earning any money. So I shouldn't spend money on myself. I shouldn't buy buy makeup or buy attractive clothing or whatever, because what was I going to need it for when it was just going to get spit up on? I didn't need to give myself adequate rest. I didn't need to do any of those things, you know. And coming into program, I had to learn how to treat myself differently, and I had to be honest with myself. And that's what we do in step four. With that searching and fearless moral inventory, the masks all go away, where I had to actually look deeply at myself. No masks allowed when I'm doing the fourth step inventory. I really had to take an honest look at myself and be connected to myself. Now, to be honest, my first inventory, since I came in I had a 5-year-old and a toddler when I came into the rooms back in the day. And so I wrote my first inventory in 5-minute increments, because that's all the uninterrupted time I could attain when I had a 5-year-old and a toddler. But the point is that I did it, and I became connected with myself. And to be out of isolation, I really have to be connected to that self. I have to be connected to God. And then in step five, I became connected to another human being, because I actually gave all of that garbage that had been living rent-free in my head for all those years, for 30 years, you know, came out into the open, and it was disinfected by sunlight. And it was so liberating to have the person I gave my fist up to be nodding her head at me and saying, yeah, I did that. One of the most freeing experiences I remember was early in my years in program. I went to this retreat. And we were at this lodge, and they did this exercise called Secrets. And as I said a minute ago, you know, we are as sick as we are secretive. And what they did was they dimmed the lights and had everything by candlelight. And we were supposed to write down the thing that we were the most ashamed of, and then fold it up on a piece of paper and put it, you know, fold the piece of paper up and put it in a basket. And then you drew out, then the basket went around and you drew out a piece of paper and you shared your experience, strength, and hope with that. And so I wrote down this thing that I was so horribly ashamed of. And the person drew it out of the basket and read it out loud. And then they said, okay, is there anybody here who didn't do this? And it was like this 1,000-pound weight dropped off my shoulders, because I was not alone. I was not this freak, because, you know, before program, you know, the thing that's so hard about the isolation of our disease is that even when we're in a group of people, we're isolated because we know we're different. I knew I was different. Nobody spoke my language. It was like I was speaking English and everybody else was speaking Klingon. Everybody else had the secret rule book for life, and I never got my copy. But when I came into that first meeting that cold February night in 86, there was this room full of people that had said the things that I said, had done the things that I'd done, had felt the things that I felt, and I was no longer alone. And that became really real and solid when I actually told my deepest, darkest secrets to another breathing human being and had them look back at me with love and acceptance. Because love and love is the other antidote to isolation. You know, I had to receive the love of the fellowship, and I received the love of the fellowship the second I walked in the door and they said, you're one of us, welcome. Welcome to away, welcome home. I received love from my higher power because I had to develop a relationship with a power that loved me. And so instead of having this belief in this Charlie Brown, this Lucy God, this vengeful God that needed Vestal virgins dropped into the volcano, instead of that, I have this perfect God that improbably loves me unconditionally and showers me with grace on a daily basis. Inconceivable before OA, but is my lived reality in today. And then as I soaked all of that in, I began to be able to actually love myself. And that enabled me then to be of service to others, because it, you know, it does, the whole process of love and connection doesn't stop with step five. It continues on with six and seven when I look at my defects of character and I examine how they can be turned into assets. As I repair my relationships in eight and nine, as I continue to clean up my garbage in 10, as I develop that relationship with my higher power in 11, and as I give back to this fellowship in 12, it is a continuing and ongoing process. Mm-hmm. Because really what I want, one of the things that was so toxic about before OA, or even in the early days, because I was a sick puppy, and just because I got the food down didn't mean that my head got sane overnight. It sure didn't. I'm never going to run out of character defects. I've still got plenty of them, some 34 years in. I just have fewer of them and they rule me less. And I spend more of my time in freedom. I'm not cured, not anything remotely resembling that. But when I was in the disease, then you've probably heard the description of the addict that you're a piece of excrement that the world happens to revolve around. So everything was all about me and what did I want? Even though I couldn't ask for it and I couldn't certainly give it to myself, I somehow expected you to take care of it. My job was to take care of you, and then you were going to fix me, right? And now I'm supposed to be of service. My prayer needs to be, how can I be of maximum service to God and to my fellows? And that in turn, when I'm doing that, then that creates this real connection relationship, because I'm receiving from you the love, and I'm willing to ask for help, and I'm receiving it when I need it, but I'm also willing to give it. Not so that I can buy self-worth, but because that's a part of the reciprocity, the give and take, that is how we're supposed to be living in life, or at least that's how I see it. All of us are put here to live out a life of service, but what I'm supposed to do isn't necessarily exactly what you're supposed to do or you're supposed to do. And it's only my job to worry about what my tasks are. I don't get to decide what yours are. So we get that virtuous cycle instead of the vicious cycle. We get the virtuous cycle of that increasing connection as we're on a common journey, living out a common purpose. And that connection just then, that connection and that love that comes from that shared journey is nourishing. Is nourishing enough that breaks the chains of that isolation. There's nothing in food that would replace that. So in addition to doing connection, how do I do self-care? Self-care, interestingly enough, self-care is a more modern term, I guess, because I didn't find that really in the index, particularly when I was doing a search in our literature. But I certainly have plenty of lived connection lived experience in self-care, because I had to learn how to practice that, because I had to let go of the old ideas that it wasn't my job to take care of me. It was other people's. I had to let go of that idea. And I had to, that was where I needed to be responsible to myself and to God. So that meant that I could actually actively look for ways to be of service. That meant that I gave myself
Excuse me? Gift. 20 minutes.
Awesome. That meant that I needed to actually give myself the gift of adequate rest. I didn't have to binge on activities. I could pick and choose. God, is this something I'm supposed to be involved in? God, is this something that I'm supposed to be doing, or is somebody else supposed to be doing that? That was a novel concept, that maybe I was crowding out someone else's opportunity to grow and to serve by doing something myself. Maybe I could just get the heck out of the way. Who would have thunk it? So I gave myself that gift. I don't believe of abstinence as punishment. Yeah, there's foods that higher power said, no, they're not my food, they're binge foods. And you know what? The thing is that I don't miss them. There, you know, people go on and on sometimes. You know, I spend time around normies, not so much right now, but, you know, in before times, pre-COVID times, I spent a lot of time around normies, and they would talk about this food or that food or whatever. And it would be something I'd never had because it came out since I got abstinent. And it's like, so? it doesn't pull. 99% of the time, my former binge foods don't draw me. But that's not to say that I don't enjoy my food. I don't believe abstinence is punishment. So it's absolutely okay for me to choose the vegetables that I like, to choose the fruit, to choose the fruits that I like. So in berry season, I have weighed and measured amounts of berries because I love them. Now, there is a weighed and measured amount, but God makes that weighed and measured amount enough. I can use herbs and spices to make my food taste pleasing to me. It doesn't have to be pleasing to somebody else except my husband, because he eats dinner with me. But, you know, but I can make the food, use the flavors that I enjoy. Food no longer has to be sex and drugs and rock and roll. But that doesn't mean it has to be a punishment. I can take joy in the activities that I choose to do and not do too many of them. By practicing 11, step 11, I'm doing self-care by connecting with my higher power. And that's a regular part of my life. Something that came into my life a few years ago was meditation. I had a prayer life before I came into OA, but meditation was something that I believed was beyond me. And I was amazed at how much more centered and serene I became when I added meditation to my life. And so I consider practicing meditation not only to be a part of living out the steps, but a part of my self-care. In fact, I would say working the steps is one of the biggest acts of self-care, and abstinence are those have to be numbers 1 and 2 on my list of self-care, because if I am not abstinent, I have nothing for myself or anyone else. I choose activities and relaxation that I enjoy. It's okay to not be working all the time. I don't have to earn my right to breathe air in the universe. I can actually do things that I find fun or relaxing. But I also can remember the joys of service. Now, you know, I make sure that I'm a part of a community, and I nourish my connections in community. First of all and foremost, that's got to be my OA community, because you guys get me the way nobody else does. There's no normie on this planet that gets me the way you guys do. But I have a spiritual community, and that means a lot to me. I have friends. I have a connection with my family. One of the many gifts I believe I've received from this program is, you know, I came into OA, my daughters were 5 and 1, and then I had a third child after I came into the rooms. And so my youngest child, who is 32, has never known a mother who didn't go to meetings, because I actually called my sponsor from the labor room and said, I'm not going to be at the meeting tonight because I'm in labor. And because my kids grew up with me in the rooms, I actually have a relationship with them that nourishes both of us, that nourishes all of us. I'm proud of them and I enjoy who they are as people. I don't love them because they're my daughters. I love them because they're the women they are. And I know that they love me. And that is truly a gift that I know I would not have received if I was still the sick woman that walked into OA back in 86. Now, does how I practice living out the connection and self-care, has it changed during COVID? Yeah, of course it has. And, you know, I don't go to face-to-face meetings at the moment. My home meeting has elected to be still virtual right now, but I can still actively participate in meetings. I can actively do service, even though it's in Zoom rather than in person. I can connect with other people by text and by phone and by Zoom, even though I'm not seeing people in person, because I'm choosing to be pretty cautious about my risk. And I can suit up and show, and I can ask my higher power to make those virtual connections enough. I make sure one of the gifts that COVID has given me is that I never used to do exercise. I quit exercise when I was in graduate school because I was working full time and going to grad school full time, and something had to go, and going to the gym was what it was. And that was, since I finished graduate school in 2003, obviously that excuse got a little stale. But giving up my commute meant that I was able to add walking to my life. And so I walk every day, and that is a wonderful gift that I give myself in my recovery. And it really enables me to connect with my higher power on my walk. And so that's a real gift. And because of the ease of connection virtually, I'm actually doing more sponsoring and more service right now in COVID life than I did when we were not in lockdown. So I get to do all of these things. And so I find that when I ask my higher power to make the kinds of connection that I can have in COVID time enough, that he does that. I'm not saying that I don't sometimes miss some of the activities that I did for fun, but my higher power has truly made those things enough. And I truly still feel connected to my fellows in and out of the rooms. And that connection with other people is one of the greatest gifts besides abstinence that I've received. And I want to close with a quote from the Big Book, from one of the stories in the Big Book, because I really feel like it says really the before and after of the isolation versus the connection. And this is from the ending of the story, The Keys of the Kingdom, in the Big Book. The last 15 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that's life. But I've also known a great deal of joy and peace that is the handmaiden of inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship, where to these people I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love. Without strength and without application, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and need never return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we've been given the keys of the kingdom. Thank you for letting me share.